From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Zeldin. On this edition of the program, Donald Trump will become the 45th U.S. president after a stunning victory over Democrat Hillary Clinton. It was the year of the outsider, and the outsider prevailed. Republican nominee Donald Trump defied the majority of pollsters who had predicted a win for Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. But the billionaire businessman benefited from a larger-than-expected turnout among his base of white rural voters, many of whom felt left behind in a changing economy and were attracted to Trump's anti-trade, anti-immigration stands. Our special guest on this edition of the program is P.J. Crowley. He's former Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs under Secretary of State Clinton, now professor and distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communications at the George Washington University. We are in uncharted waters, but he is here to help us understand the implications of a Trump presidency for U.S. foreign and national security policy. P.J. Crowley, welcome to the program.
A pleasure to be back, Carol.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague, Jeff Zeldin.
Glad to be here.
Well, P.J. Crowley, of course, full disclosure, many of us thought that Hillary Clinton would have won, and we invited you in that context. You worked for her. You know her very well. What is your reaction to this outcome?
I think your summary is pretty apt, that in a period of anti-establishment politics, the anti-establishment candidate prevailed over the conventional candidate. What that means in terms of America's relationship, you know, with the world, you know, we'll have to wait and see. You know, Donald Trump was in fact an outsider. He ran as an outsider. He won as an outsider. But now he comes to Washington and will inherit a government. He will confront a very, very complex global situation. So there will be obviously what he said on the campaign trail does have meaning, but obviously that will be tempered by a number of forces, you know, particularly the world he inherits and the situation he inherits beginning on January 21st.
Quick follow-up. What are some of the factors that you think, in addition to this year of the outsider, this anti-establishment sentiment, the anxiety among many people around the country, what other factors do you think account for his victory? And I'm referring, for example, to perhaps the way he conducted his campaign. The rhetoric was disturbing to many people, misogynistic
right.
comments.
I mean, it was a highly negative campaign. Obviously, on the eve of the election, Hillary Clinton herself expressed regret over the tone of the campaign. I think it's multiple things. One has to understand that there is an aspect of history here in the sense that the American people have been used to, you know, for example, in recent decades, 8 years of Democratic president, 8 years Republican, 8 years Democratic. So in that sense, it was the Republicans' turn. Obviously, another aspect of history was that, you know, Hillary Clinton aspired to be the first woman to be president of the United States. And for a variety of reasons, perhaps I don't think we ever got to the point where we felt the historical nature of her candidacy in the same way that we did Barack Obama's 8 years ago. But I think you really have to come back to this anti-establishment aspect. The domestic political environment reflected in the global political environment. If you put, you know, Brexit, you know, together with the recent vote by the Colombian people expressing skepticism over the peace agreement with the FARC, and now this election, you see the significant intersection of government policy and politics roiled by a political environment that now social media has played a role in this. So it's a very complex political environment. Obviously, Donald Trump tapped into a very significant political vein that will shape his domestic policy and also shape his foreign policy.
We're talking to P.J. Crowley. He's former Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. He worked for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Red Line, American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failing States. Let me turn to my colleague, Jeff Zeldin, for a question.
Just a moment ago, you mentioned Brexit, and it was interesting, as the results were coming in on Election Eve, the French ambassador to the U.S. put out a tweet referencing Brexit and saying how the world seemed to be crumbling around him. And while it's tempting to look at this in the context of American politics and the trends and the factors driving American voters, is there something much larger going on? And what types of challenges will that present for the Trump presidency, for his foreign policy, even as he's outlined several differences in his approach compared to what we've seen from President Obama and President Bush before him?
Sure. And just one other anti-establishment trend to throw into the mix here is obviously the 2011 Arab Spring. So we are in a very turbulent time in terms of global politics, and obviously the United States is not immune to that. There's an interesting myth. I've spent 30 years in the foreign policy and national security world, and the myth always said that politics should stop at the water's edge. And yet we see politics infused in how it has shaped the parameters or the borders within which presidents operate. If you go back to the 2000 election, for example, George W. Bush ran on a fairly conventional foreign policy. He was skeptical of the humanitarian interventions of the 1990s. And then the existing political boundaries evaporated on September 11, and President Bush was free to craft a narrative around the so-called war on terror. You know, you're either with us or against us. And then he crafted a strategy around that narrative. To some extent, the political boundaries returned in 2008. And as we approach the end of the Obama administration, one can say that whether it was the right foreign policy, the wrong foreign policy, President Obama largely delivered the foreign policy that he projected on the campaign trail in 2008, re-engaged the world, try to find common cause with allies, engage adversaries such as Iran, and be more judicious in the use of military power. I still think that those boundaries were, to a large extent, reinforced in the 2016 campaign. I think Mr. Trump will lead an internationalist foreign policy. He's highly skeptical of nation building, as one example, but he will be selective in terms of where the United States intervenes and continuing narrowing of how we define American interests.
Well, let's get to some specifics. Even though we know that Mr. Trump doesn't have a thick book of policy prescriptions, but he does have a lot of slogans and general themes. For example, he wants to rip up the Iran deal. Initially, he talked about a ban on Muslims. Now he talks about extreme vetting. Now, this is worrisome for our Muslim friends around the world. With respect to immigration, he talked about building a wall on the border with Mexico. How do you see any of these playing out in terms of actual policies?
There's no question that the rhetoric on the campaign trail was very divisive, and that has had an impact in terms of global perceptions of the United States. The next president, whether it was President Trump or President Clinton, was going to have to try to look to repair that damage. I think, obviously, Mr. Trump in his acceptance remarks sounded conciliatory notes. He's going to have to carry that into the Oval Office as he shapes a foreign policy. He's the outsider candidate that now will inherit a government bureaucracy. That is necessarily going to temper him to a significant degree. Even as we sit here, the markets have opened and are showing some turbulence. Obviously, he's going to have to do some things on the domestic side and on the international economic side to reassure people who are not certain what he stands for. So he'll have to fill in some of those blanks, Carol, in terms of what was rhetoric and what will actually shape a Trump foreign policy. We'll get a hint of that in terms of the people he selects to be his key advisors on the national security front.
Indeed. And do you have any sense of who they might be? I recall an interesting story. This was, I think, during the primary campaign when I think his son approached John Kasich, the governor of Ohio. He was one of the candidates during the primaries for the Republican nomination. He was approached to be potentially a vice presidential candidate. And when he asked the son, well, what would he be doing? Well, you'd be in charge of foreign and domestic policy. I mean,
that was a strange moment.
So, again, is there a potential silver lining there? I mean, would he delegate so much to others? And who would they be? Because he has railed against the so-called establishment Republican
Well, the reality is that the United States as a global power is the only country with a truly global foreign policy. America has a view on every nook and cranny on Earth. And even though we are approaching a change in the occupant of the Oval Office, American interests don't necessarily change dramatically from one election to the next. So there is significant continuity in American foreign policy, and I would expect that to continue. Now, I would say that, first and foremost, that may be reflected, for example, in the situation in Syria. If Mr. Trump has a mandate or a clear signal from the American people, it is defeat the Islamic State militarily, deal with Bashar al-Assad politically, and try to find common cause with countries that have a vested interest in Syria, first and foremost, Russia. So notwithstanding some of the sharp rhetoric, both Republicans and Democratic candidates tended to more or less arrive where President Obama already is in terms of Syria. I think a very significant challenge for Mr. Trump will be, how do you interpret what Russia just did in the context of this election? Every indication is that Russia intervened through the hacks of various computer networks to try to at least undermine American democracy and perhaps undermine the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. That is an act of aggression. Whether he admires Putin and his leadership style, obviously he will confront a situation where he'll have to build a relationship with Putin in an environment where the common interests between Russia and the United States are shrinking, and the points of friction, whether it's Syria or Ukraine or cybersecurity, are expanding. That's going to be a very, very difficult challenge.
Well, we'll have more on that in a moment and the reaction of NATO allies and others. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is P.J. Crowley. He's former Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, currently professor and distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communications at the George Washington University. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Red Line, American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failing States. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA national correspondent Jeff Selden. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Werepre Isaiah. He's from Delta State in Nigeria and has been a loyal listener since 1995. If you want to hear your name on the air and give us some feedback on this show as well, then send an email to pcusa@voanews.com and like us or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now let me turn to Jeff Selden.
Speaking of Russia, it wasn't so long ago, or perhaps it was, depending on your view of time, that the United States had talked about resetting the relationship with Russia, and it hasn't gone so well. Many people you talk to say that it's as tense a relationship as it's been in quite some time. Given that Trump is such an unknown in terms of how he will carry out foreign policy, and the fact that he seems to have made some overtures to say having a better relationship with Russia wouldn't be such a bad thing, does that present perhaps an opportunity where Russia, despite the animosity, might see that there's a chance to, again, try to reset the relationship, but perhaps Russia will see it as a possibility on terms that are more acceptable to Moscow?
It's a great question, Jeff. And I think that if you look back over the past couple of administrations, George W. Bush had a reasonable relationship with Vladimir Putin early in his administration, but by the end was very disillusioned as he saw the Russian incursion into Georgia. I think it was a reasonable policy option to try to reset relations with Russia, and the reset paid dividends in the context of the presidency of Dmitry Medvedev. But reset ended clearly with the return of Vladimir Putin to power in 2012. I think that while the United States is not going to get more deeply involved in Syria, the shift from President Obama to President Trump does provide an opportunity to reset the context of Russian-U.S. cooperation in Syria, whether right or wrong, good or bad, we can argue in the coming weeks and months. I think Mr. Putin may not be as centrally focused on the future of Bashar al-Assad as President Obama, supported by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was. Of course, that has grave implications. The Syrian civil war is very significantly about Bashar al-Assad. Trump may seek to find common ground with Russia where the defeat of the Islamic State, but the preservation of the Syrian regime. But I think he's going to find that, you know, without a solution to Bashar al-Assad, there may or may not be a real way to end the Syrian civil war on grounds that are acceptable to the United States and other countries that are invested in that. So there may be an opportunity for a change in approach, but I think he, you know, like his two predecessors, will over time find it difficult to do business with Vladimir Putin. They don't see, you know, the world in similar ways.
Well, of course, many analysts would say that the very presence of Bashar al-Assad is a recruiting tool for the terrorists, especially for the likes of ISIS, the Islamic State.
And obviously that's been borne out. The emergence of the Islamic State, there's actually significant unity in the region about defeating the caliphate. But when you get to what was called Jabhat al-Nusra, now is called Jabhat Fatah al-Sham. But there, obviously, yes, you're right, that without a political solution to the Syrian civil war, it's going to be very, very difficult to deal with the threat of extremism that affects the United States and more profoundly affects Europe. So I think that there will be, in every transition, there's a thorough review of policy. I think he may all try to be more pragmatic with Russia. I mean, and actually, even as we struggle to find common cause with Syria, even as we sharply disagree over what to do about Ukraine, there is a need for Russian cooperation in the nonproliferation area. And that may be an area that where, you know, Putin will give something to get something.
What about the Iran deal that he has vowed to rip up?
I thought that he preserved some flexibility on that. Yes, you're right. In terms of the various Republican campaign debates, a number of candidates said they would rip up the agreement on the first day in office. I thought that Trump, you know, was skeptical. He thought it was the worst deal ever. By the same token, I don't think he laid down a hard marker in terms of how he would respond to that. And of course, American allies have already reminded Republicans on Capitol Hill in response to that letter that Senator Cotton engineered a few months ago that notwithstanding what the United States might do in withdrawing from the agreement, this is an international agreement endorsed by the United Nations. And regardless of what the United States tries to do, those others who are parties to the agreement are going to continue to proceed forward in it. So I think we're not going to see a change in the context of the relationship between the United States and Iran. And I think obviously already maybe President Obama had a hope that the Iran nuclear deal might open up some other avenues for cooperation on Syria. And I think that has not materialized. The one thing that the nuclear deal did produce was a authoritative, you know, channel of communication between the United States and Iran. Hopefully that will be preserved, but I think we're finding that the politics on both sides of this, you know, there are hardline politics in the United States reflected in much of the campaign rhetoric. There's hardline politics in Iran, and I think there's a practical limit to where this relationship will go anytime soon.
Because Trump is such an unknown in terms of how he'll actually respond on the global stage, does that give him some advantage, whereas Iran became used to the way that the Obama administration had operated or was familiar with the way the Bush administration had operated before that, because there had been some sense of continuity in American foreign policy? Does the fact that Trump has come in saying all the things that he has, does that make him enough of an unknown quantity that perhaps it could put adversaries like Iran at somewhat of a disadvantage because now they don't know what the game is going to be?
I don't think that even with the nuclear deal, you've got prevailing narratives that have significant political resonance on all sides of this. For the United States, we've looked at Iran as a rogue nation. I think that narrative will be reinforced by a Trump administration. And likewise, you know, Iran has looked at the United States as the great Satan, you know, and I don't think that that narrative is going away either. So I think that to me, the nuclear deal will probably hold only because of the significant political costs of trying to unravel it. But obviously, I think we're going to go through kind of a refreezing of the situation. And of course, the flip side of that coin is you'll certainly see a different tone in the relationship between the United States and Israel. I mean, notwithstanding the political friction between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, the fact is that over 8 years of the Obama administration, the strategic relationship between the United States and Israel actually deepened profoundly. And I think you're going to have a continuation of the substance of that relationship, probably a change in the tone. I don't think the United States is necessarily going to publicly put Israel on the spot. And I think that has implications in terms of the prospects for Middle East peace. I don't see that necessarily being a priority for a Trump administration. But the reality is that the politics in the region, the dynamic between the Israelis and Palestinians today, that has not necessarily enabled, you know, an agreement despite a couple of concerted efforts by the Obama administration.
Certainly, the two-state solution seems more elusive than ever.
Yes, there's not a political dynamic in the region that necessarily will enable that to move forward. And I don't think you're going to see, you know, a Trump administration, you know, look to that, to a potential a negotiation, you know, with the idea of being even-handed. Remember, you know, although Mr. Trump himself in one of the debates said, hey, I want to be even-handed in a negotiation, he kind of backed off that. I think you're going to see a change in the tone of the relationship with Israel, not necessarily a change in the substance.
Some regional analysts would argue that the dynamic actually would favor it. That is, that you see the Sunni Arab states and Israel converging on a number of issues that they didn't before, fighting Islamist extremism, particularly, you know, the Islamic State, and seeing, you know, Iran as the hegemon and both sharing a fear. But you don't think that would outweigh?
Yeah, I mean, but all of this is interconnected, right? Yes, you do see that under the surface, there's very significant continuity in interests between the major Sunni states and Israel. How that translates on the ground, it will be very, very complex.
Indeed, how that would translate into potentially encouraging greater rapprochement between the Israelis and Palestinians, that's...
To me, that moment requires a change in leadership on both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side.
Indeed. Now, what about trade, you know, international trade? Historically, the Republican Party has favored trade agreements, but we have also an upset within the Republican Party, a backlash against so-called mainstream Republicans. Many, particularly among the Tea Party, do not like trade agreements. Trump has railed against trade agreements, particularly NAFTA, even though trade agreements have improved over time. Many say that the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is written in such a way that does not hurt workers nearly as much, that it would protect the environment. But it doesn't seem to be popular either. Where are we going on trade?
Well, I think that's going to be a domestic political challenge for Donald Trump. Obviously, his message, his anti-trade message, did resonate within his base. They are the ones who are responsible for his election. But as we know, while certainly American blue-collar workers have been affected by changes in global trade, the greatest impact is not about trade. The greatest impact is about automation and productivity and not jobs that have been shipped overseas, jobs that just no longer are required. So I think he's going to have trouble on that front politically. And obviously, I think over time, every president, whether a Democratic president or Republican president, comes back to these issues of how growing your economy requires increasing trade with your key partners. I think there's going to be very significant friction in terms of the relationship between the United States and Mexico, even though Mexico is our second leading trading partner. But I think over time, once he finds ways to kind of address that political sentiment, I think inevitably you'll see a Trump administration come back, you know, to the question of TPP, whether it survives or not, really hard to predict at this point. But also on the other side of the ledger, the Trump administration will be watching very closely how Europe adjusts to its changes. You know, what happens to Brexit? What does that mean in terms of Britain's relationship with continental Europe? And then what does that mean in terms of relations between the UK and Europe and the United States? I think actually a trade agreement with the United Kingdom, which may be required if the United Kingdom goes forward with its Brexit, may be a way to unlock that.
What about skittish NATO allies wondering to what extent a President Trump would force them to pay to play? In other words, he's talked about...
What Trump said during the campaign is actually something that American secretaries of state and secretaries of defense have said repeatedly in NATO conferences over the past two decades, which is expressing concern about European countries and their commitment to a percentage of GDP towards defense. I think, on the one hand, his comment about NATO being obsolete, I think, is defied by what we're seeing in terms of an assertive Russia and the genuine concern that we have among our allies in Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. He started to come off that a little bit, but I think, obviously, that's one area where, you know, there'll be some symbolic understandings reached with European allies, with Japan, with South Korea, to help him then make a shift that understands that. Obviously, what he's saying is that, you know, allies need to commit their fair share. I think what I'll find out once he's in office is defining that commitment in different ways, in terms of basing rights, basing support. You know, he'll find that allies are probably doing more than he recognizes, although clearly everyone would suggest that as you're going forward, you know, solving these problems are things that where the country's allies have to come together. He'll find ways to do that.
During the campaign, there was a lot of isolationist tone to what Donald Trump was saying. Ultimately, though, how far can the U.S. really pull back from the world stage? And to what extent would that have an impact? There were some tweets as the election results were coming in. One of them I saw, it was meant in jest, but it said, "Congratulations, Angela Merkel, you're now the leader of the free world." Are we looking at a situation where the U.S. is no longer going to be seen as the world's policeman? Is Donald Trump ultimately, for all his talk of a strong America, willing to cede more power to other countries?
And just a quick addition to that, with respect to values, words do matter. And the language that our Muslim allies around the world are hearing about banning Muslims, sure, the misogynistic comments, women, whereas the United States has always wanted to promote the status of women around the world, how do you square that with the language of Mr. Trump?
Well, I mean, first on your point, Jeff, about not being the world's policeman. Obviously, you know, there are competing narratives here. You know, one narrative is American exceptionalism or American indispensability. And of course, you know, Trump talked to that by saying making America, you know, great again. I think there is skepticism on both sides of the aisle, stemming from U.S. experience in Iraq, over where is that line where you're serving American interests without necessarily getting intractably involved in conflicts that the United States really can't resolve. But I think that there's been a misnomer in the Obama administration that the Obama administration disengaged in the world. What the Obama administration started was to be far more judicious about the use of hard power and try to use soft power, political power, to solve problems. Notwithstanding, you know, Trump's rhetoric, I think he's in that same vein. He's going to be careful. He wants America to be strong, but I think he's going to be very careful in where he uses that power, expressly because once you turn that on, it's an expensive proposition once you begin to try to reorder a country, whether it's like Afghanistan or Iraq, or Syria, or Yemen, or Libya. These are very, very complex situations. I think there will be an internationalist foreign policy, but somewhat like the Obama administration, there's going to be greater caution in terms of where and how the United States intervenes directly.
Does he do something early on, maybe symbolically, to show America's strength? One of the criticisms of the Obama administration came down to the Syria policy, where President Obama drew the red line and then seemed to, you know, the planes were on the runway, ready to go on a bombing run. He pulled them back. A lot of people saw that as the U.S. showing itself to be nothing more than a paper tiger. Does Trump look at something like that and make a symbolic move to, at least in the view of the world, in the public view, say the United States is strong?
I think we're going to face a more realistic American foreign policy in that respect. It kind of gets to the point that Carol was raising a minute ago. Much more focus on American interests, probably a little bit less focus on American values. We're not necessarily going to worry about the character of our allies. We're going to worry about what they can do to help us solve a problem that is a threat to the United States. So I think there will be, you know, some adjustments, most of them rhetorical. But I think in the strain of George W. Bush, if he commits to something, he's probably going to follow through.
P.G. Crowley is former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. He's now a professor at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communications at the George Washington University. He has a new book coming out, Redline: American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failing States. P.J. Crowley, thank you very much for your terrific insights.
You're welcome.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. Joining me on the program was VOA National Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA
on The Voice of America.